Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not able to be with us today. But our guest today will more than make up for the absence of my mother and co-host. Linda Moore is an author, traveler, and recovering gallery owner. Her gallery featured contemporary artists from Latin America, Spain, and the United States, and she has exhibited at numerous art fairs. And she has her debut novel, Attribution, won the 2023 National Indie Excellence Award in Literary Fiction, the Independent Publisher Book Awards Gold Medal, and several other fantastic awards. She has published award-winning exhibition catalogs, and her writing has appeared in art journals and anthologies. She resides with her book-collecting husband in San Diego and finds quiet to write in their cottage on Kauai. And the book we're talking about today is 5 Days in Bogota, which is a novel that sounds almost autobiographical because of Linda's own background. So we will be asking her about that. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Linda.
Good morning, and thank you so much. I really am looking forward to talking with you.
Great. So 5 Days in Bogota is set in 1990, I believe.
Correct.
Yes. And it is about an art gallery owner from San Diego, like you,
yes.
who exhibits artists from Latin America, Spain, and the United States, like you.
Also fit.
And who travels to Bogota for an art fair, like you.
Yes, also. Right.
Right.
At what point are you going to hit the one that doesn't fit?
probably when she gets kidnapped and almost killed.
One, yes. Yeah.
or maybe when she gets involved in something to deal with stolen artworks. I'm assuming you didn't do that.
No. No, but, you know, I actually could dig up, I thought about this, some adventures where I was close to being kidnapped, but didn't happen. So.
Wow. So, first of all, Bogota in 1990 was not a very safe place.
Correct.
And why your character went, and you know, she was trying to basically save her family from financial disaster, Allie Blake, after her husband dies unexpectedly and leaves with a financial mess, and she feels like this is her one way out. But why did you go to Bogota in the 90s?
Well, you know, the behind the story is kind of I was trying to help a friend, and the friend is also not exactly right, but a character in the book, friend was Santiago, who was on the committee for this first ever art fair, and he, his name is not Santiago, as you might imagine, the real guy, and he was really struggling to get American gallerists to come. And that was his assignment because of exactly what you said. It was so dangerous. And I am much more familiar with Latin America probably than most American gallery owners because I'd been working there for some time. So I just kind of on a whim said, oh, I'll come. You know, why not? That'll be really interesting. And at that point, I'd never been to Bogota. And so, and it's a fairly important city in all of Latin America as a capital. And so I jumped in. And honestly, when I look back on it, I think about how kind of spontaneous that decision was. And once I was committed, of course, I had to see it through. And I just figured that I could rely on the fair people to provide proper security.
And was that a safe assumption or not?
Well, what that meant was when we got to the hotel, there were guys standing at the entrance of the hotel holding automatic weapons in uniforms. And I mean, if you've ever been, of course, I was a veteran of college campus unrest during the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s. So marching to school through National Guardsmen and so forth was not an unusual thing to me. But nevertheless, at that point, I was a student. I wasn't a mom of two kids and, you know, with a whole nother life. So it was more sort of, okay, you're in it. You have to get through it. But I did not witness any violence, put it that way. But we did get pulled over. I did get a packet from the U.S. Embassy. I've never had that happen in all my travels, telling me things like I wrote in that first chapter. And that had never happened to me before. So
wow.
It's sort of, you know, set the stage for this unusual environment.
I have to say, I've twice had the experience of being in an environment where you run into young men with machine guns, young men in uniform with machine guns. And neither time did that make me feel safer. One was flying. Shortly after 9/11 and going to the airports and apparently it was the Cedar Rapids airport. And I think there were some munitions factories in the area. And that's why they had these armed guards at these little, a small regional airport basically. And, like I said, that did not give me a sense of security. The other time was in Jamaica and being at, went to the Blue Lagoon and went kind of hiking up in the hills and run into the guards with the machine guns and like, oops, what is going on here? Now I'm sure they were trying to make sure the tourists were safe, probably. But
well, hard to know. I think it's a lot more nerve-wracking in a foreign country where you don't kind of know the rules of the game, like. You know, comparing that college campus stuff where, you know, okay, call a lawyer, don't say anything. You kind of know some things that protect you. But I was also a student in Madrid when Franco was there, and that was in the late 60s also. And it was a turbulent time. I would say I was more worried then than I was in Bogota because the police would come on horseback, swinging clubs through the crowds of students, and people flee. And one of the things I learned, very important, a little tidbit, if you see people all running one direction, don't go that way. Take a right turn or a left turn and go down a side street or between a different building, because if you follow the crowd and you're not the fastest runner, you're going to be the next one in line to get hit with a club. And a friend of mine reminded me recently, we reconnected. He was in Madrid with me, that he was on the dorm steps and he actually got hit and he still walks with a limp today.
Oh, my
from
goodness.
From being hit with a club. But in Spain, that was very common to come to school in the morning. If you saw the newspapers had disappeared from the stands, you knew something was up and best not to even go to school. And the typically, yeah, a lot of really scary stuff happened. And they closed the university for 4 months while I was there. In 1968, 68 was a turbulent time, and you learn a lot about political systems and why they're important and why we have to treasure the due process protections that we have. And of course, these days I'm watching television. I'm thinking a lot is coming flashing back to me about those days.
Yeah, we're living in scary times again.
And the funny part is for the unrest in Vietnam, I remember a lot of academic administrators learned a very important lesson. And that is, if you ignore students for long enough, they get bored, hungry, and tired and go home. And you don't have to do anything. Of course, we weren't so clever as to have tents and such, right?
Right. Plus social media. There was no social media exactly. back then. It was a lot harder to communicate. I got to admit, I'm not paying as much attention to the campus unrest as I probably should be. I'm not quite sure what to think about it. It's hard to know what to think. But they have the right to protest, in my opinion.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think you can protect one point of view's voice without protecting the other one. Yeah. And I absolutely agree with academic administrators. Say, hey, look, our purpose is to foster dialogue. And why are we failing to have this dialogue in a respectful, safe setting where everyone can share ideas? And I think it's actually kind of a troubling time when everybody's so certain of their position. There's no room for nuance or uncertainty or, you know, somehow enlightening facts from the other side. We just are not listening. So it's not a new thing. It's not a new thing at all.
So it sounds like one of the other things that is in the book that you did experience or did have was being in Madrid and buying a copy of a very famous book there. Yes, would you like to tell us about that?
That book is actually right here. I can see it from where I'm sitting. Yes, and that's a section of the book that I wanted to read. So if you like, I can read it now.
Let's do that.
So let me set the scene.
Okay.
Was Allie Blake, who is the fearless and desperately broke gallery owner, and she is at the fair. She's been alerted by the U.S. State Department that Garcia Marquez is coming to the art fair with the president, then Gaviria, and he will be coming to her booth to particularly see this California artist's work. So that kind of sets the stage. She sees him arriving around the corner, and she walks up to greet him. She approached him with the butterflies of a teenage groupie. Señor Marquez, she offered her hand. He kissed her hand, no air kiss, a real kiss. Encantado. We're thrilled that you're here, able to be here. May I offer you some wine? I'm not feeling so well, no indulging myself, but please go ahead. He paused. I'd like to see this art. She pointed at a vertical painting of a colorful figure. This California artist interprets Macondo and El Coronel in his work. His art embraces Colombia's vibrant culture, described in your book. He came closer. Fascinating work. These collages have text from your novels compared to text from William Faulkner. She removed the encaustic box from the wall. The artist sees a connection. Paper scraps of text from his book and the artist's sketches covered the glass enclosed surface. Marquez adjusted his glasses, studied the words. He smiled and looked up. So what happens is I forget. I forget what I wrote. She laughed and he laughed. I barely recognize it in translation. His eyes sparkled with life despite well-earned weary lines surrounding them. No matter the political affronts he suffered, there were also grooves that recorded many moments of laughter. His face mapped the history and spirit of Latin America. He returned the painting to her, and she offered it back to him. The artist, De Las McGraw, asked me to make a gift of this small painting to you. How generous. Thank you. What a pleasure. He looked closely at the work and then at her. I want to give you a gift, too. When do you leave? He looked back to one of his assistants waiting at the edge of the booth, holding back a whole group of fans following him. Being close to him brought national pride and wisdom, hope to people of all stations. She regrouped to respond, Sunday, we leave late Sunday. Marquez motioned to the assistant and asked her to gather Allison's contact information. Allie had another thought and asked, perhaps a simple thing you could do. It would be a great gift for me. I've heard you don't sign autographs. May I ask you anyway? Would you sign this old copy of 100 Years of Solitude? She'd brought this Spanish version in case someone asked her about the translated lines in Margaux's paintings. He took the tattered book with the coffee stains on the cover from her student days into his hands. Marquez turned it over again and again. His eyes filled with emotion. Where did you get this? Was he offended by her careless treatment of the famous book that she'd bought over 20 years ago? Madrid, 1967. I was a student at the university there. She shifted from one foot to another while he examined the book, even reading the copyright page. Finally, he spoke. This is a very special edition, printed by Editorial Sudamericana in Buenos Aires. Political issues with Cuba, my friend Fidel, dominated the news in my life, kept me out of the United States for years. When the print run was shipped from Buenos Aires to Colombia, the Colombian government impounded all the books and, that sad look returned, destroyed the entire shipment. She gasped and stayed silent, considering the loss of precious books, this masterwork. The idea that any books, however famous, well-written or not, could be destroyed disgusted her. He spoke in a quiet voice, absent the rage she felt. Some copies got out of Argentina, mostly to Madrid. This is the first time I have held this paperback edition in my hands in many years. Can you imagine my joy to learn it survived and made this journey back to Colombia? He lifted his reading glasses off his forehead and focused his eyes on hers. You've made me happy twice in a few minutes. He smiled and searched his other pocket for a pin, which his assistant produced like handing an instrument to a surgeon. Marquez, a writer without a pen. That was something she'd remember. He scribbled on the title page of her book, closed it, and handed it back to her with a pensive look. And took her hand and kissed it. A pleasure I will not forget. If I can do anything, anything at all to help you while you're here, take my private number. He nodded to his assistant and she handed her a business card with a handwritten phone number. Allie tucked the card into her pocket, although she would never ask a favor of her new friend unless she was beyond desperate. He picked up the McGraw painting, studied it, and whispered, like Colombia, many layers, joy and tragedy, always rich with life. He kissed her hand again and said, Colombia is more than what you see. Look beyond the headlines and you will find love and dignity. No words could match his, but she hoped he saw the affection and gratitude in her eyes. He moved on a little unsteady, taking the crowd with him. She opened the book where he'd drawn a sketch of a flower and read, Una linda flor, Gabriel. 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 Not Gabo, not Garcia Marquez, just Gabriel. She clutched the book and closed her eyes.
And that was Linda Moore reading from 5 Days in Bogota. What is it, Linda, about the art world that invites, that people are so interested in reading about mystery and suspense and so many thrillers are set in the art world?
Well, I think it has a couple of different elements to other valuable things that one might steal or trade or forge or whatever. And that is that we tend to keep a lot secret and quiet. Like donor collectors like to be anonymous. They don't necessarily want the world to know. You probably experienced the idea that some artwork has sold at auction for an incredible millions and millions of dollars and no one knows who bought it. And that's fairly typical. And that, of course, is very inviting to thieves and other criminals because they can take things. There are also all kinds of unusual contrivances that make it possible to hide what you've owned. And the idea, which is kind of comes through in the book, that you can have something very small and unassuming that no customs agent or no even police person who isn't specially trained will recognize to be as valuable as you think. I mean, I visited homes where people have inherited things and they have no clue what they have. And that has happened to a lot of art dealers, a lot of auction people who come to look at something at someone's home, and then they will recognize something on the wall that an individual might have put into a garage sale. And sometimes they do put them into garage sales and they're out there on the table and you read stories. I read one recently about a woman who went to the Salvation Army shop in Texas. I think it was Houston. I can't remember. But in any case, she bought a Roman head from 2 BC for like $30. And whoa, those stories are so intriguing, aren't they?
They are. And then the other thing that I think makes it so interesting is that something can be worth very little one day, but then an artist gets discovered or something, and suddenly things are very valuable.
That is another reason that the art world invites a lot of crime, is how do you decide what is the value of a painting? And I always answer people, the market decides. But the market is also manipulated. And I think this is unusual, but it does happen where a group will get together and decide that an artist all of a sudden is going to be, the new hit thing, the new in thing. And they will, establish prices by buying from each other. And that pumps it up and starts to float a market, creates a buzz, and then, it takes off. I mean, I have to say, you deal in a world of books. I see this same thing in books where a lot of hype can, I mean, you get anointed by Oprah or Reese. Does that mean it's a great piece of literature? Not necessarily. You know, you've struck it because somebody has endorsed you. And that same phenomena happens in the art world. So I prefer, and I always did when I was more collecting than I am now, to buy from young contemporary artists where I see their interesting art and I find something I appreciate. And I will buy, and I would say this to collectors too, is it will always have value to you. No matter what, none of us can predict what will happen in the future, but you bought this painting for $1,000 or something, and, you know, it will always have value to you. And the curious thing is, when I've been in a situation, and it's happened a few times with the Latin American artists, where I introduced their art to the U.S., and little by little, other people jumped on board. Sometimes they would, tell the artist they'd only represent them if they had some big New York gallery or London gallery, only if they had an exclusive, which meant all of a sudden Linda can't get paintings anymore. But the prices would go up, up, up. And then people would contact me and say, can you get me a this or a that? And I would contact those people who bought the paintings at the very first blush. And it's not surprising, really, but not once did I have one of those people be willing to sell their painting?
Seriously?
Even though they could have sold it for 100 times what they paid for it. Yeah, because why? They bought it because they loved it, and they still love it, and that has value for them. Those works of art become like friends. Mm. You know, you come home at night and you see your friends. They're there waiting for you.
Well, I've bought a lot of works of art from local artists. I don't think any of them are probably worth any more than what I paid for them, but who knows? Maybe someday. That's,
Yeah, I'm loving the piece over your shoulder. I don't think
that's a local artist. Yeah, and here's another one. Well, a local Iowa artist. Here's another one I had of hanging in front of me.
Oh, very O'Keefe, all of these things.
Yeah,
see that yourself. Yeah, but not. I mean, but with their own style, and that's something special too. Is that you're not so derivative that you don't have an original idea of your own. And that's something we used to look for in artists.
So another thing that, of course, makes art, the art world sort of open for criminality is that artworks can be copied. And it can be very difficult to tell a copy from the original.
Well, it's much easier to copy contemporary works than old. People who copy older works are very sophisticated. For example, there are tests which can identify, like if it's painted on canvas, the linen fibers in the canvas, not only their age, but the region where they were grown. Can you imagine? All kinds of x-rays and chemical analysis of the pigments. I mean, it's very much easier now with scientific methods to rule out a painting as not legitimate. Now, it gets complicated when paintings have been restored over 400 or 500 years and then people are using contemporary pigments or some other technique, or they've, messed up restoring a hand or something, and experts can say, well, that was not painted by Titian because that's not how he painted hands or eyes. I mean, I forget who it was who just put a fleck of white in everybody's eyeball, and if that fleck is missing, it's not by that artist. And yeah, there's it's tough. But people are good at it. I mean, and they have fooled a lot of experts. I'm a big fan of that show on BBC called Fake or Fortune, where they have a team of people who go around or are invited by various art institutions run by the National Trust in England, in the UK, and they pull pieces that people say, well, this is a Bruegel or this is a, a Van Dyck or whatever, and they will then go through this whole analysis, and you see it is not black and white. There's a lot of gray in between.
I was just a week and a half ago up in St. Louis at the St. Louis Art Museum went to see the Matisse exhibit there. But they had a whole section on how they analyze paintings now and how they can look beneath the surface and see the original sketches and see how the painting changed. So there was a video on that very famous Matisse painting of the bathers with a turtle.
Right.
And how, where the characters were on the original painting and or on the original drawing and how they got moved. And sometimes it was fairly late in the process where he moved them, painted over something and moved it. And you can see it all through the various forms of analysis that they do now, which is really fascinating.
It is fascinating. And when I wrote my first book, Attribution, it was my debut novel. I was inspired by a lecture I had attended with a young curator talking about how he had worked to attribute a painting. I thought it was riveting. The best of forensic techniques, right, to discover whether this work was what he thought it was. And then there were all the political dimensions of these titans who didn't want to be ruled wrong in their own analysis. Reputations were on the line, so to speak.
And how do they know in the end who's right and who's wrong?
Well, is it ever finished?
Yeah.
Is attribution ever finished is your question. Yeah. There are some works that are, you know, much cleaner, put it that way. Like, for example, Velázquez painted in the royal court of Philip IV. And many people in the world did not know Velázquez's work for hundreds of years after those paintings were made. Why? Because they were in the private royal apartments. They were made in his studio in the royal palace. They went over and hung on the king's bedroom wall or whatever, and they never left. And so that's pretty easy, isn't it?
Yeah. To say?
Now, could someone have come in and took away the original and replaced it with a forgery? Yeah, that could be a story, right? But these things, so the provenance, so one thing is the attribution, who created the work, and the provenance, where has it been since it was created? And when things have disappeared, that opens the door for a copy or a fake to come up and say, oh, this is it. And then everybody argues and fights about it. Someone said once that 40% of the works in American museums may be are probably wrongly attributed, which is huge.
Oh,
right?
My gosh. Yeah. And of course, the Nazis really screwed things up.
Well, yeah, but way before them, way before them, there was this thing called the Grand Tour, where people in late 1800s, wealthy people would take off and they'd go to Europe and they'd end up in Venice. And someone would say, oh, this is a Canaletto of the Venice harbors and canals. And they would buy it and bring it home, and they would hold on to it for a few generations. And then finally nobody wanted it, or there were no heirs. So it would land in a museum with that information, what the family remembered about it. And we know family stories get corrupted over time. And that's true of these attributions. But the museums, to their credit, have not got the budget to do the kind of analysis, very expensive, nailing down all those tests and chemical analyses and so forth. So they just hang on the wall with the information they were given with the donation. And that's part of the problem. So
yeah, that makes sense. So back to what you were reading from 5 Days in Bogota. So about your the Allie Blake meeting Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You actually met this famous writer as well.
Well, that scene is that scene is written the way it happened. So it was written the way it happened. I can show you. I know you're. I should have this out. So here it is, the book.
Oh, wow.
And you can see how tattered it is. Now, your listeners can't see, but here's the autograph.
Oh.
And it actually says, Una Flor para Linda.
Uh-huh.
But since Allie is not named Linda, I changed it in the book. And it's signed Gabriel.
Uh-huh.
And so, yes, I did meet him. He was so kind and generous. And the thing that struck me a lot was I had written to the U.S. Cultural attaché in Bogota and said, which was really a bold move. It was kind of like the thing I used to do when I was younger, didn't know better. I just said, well, what have I got to lose, right? And they actually asked him and invited him to come to the fair. And he wrote back and said he declined because he was accompanying the president with 11 other presidents from Latin American countries at some big conference in Medellin. So he was not able to make it. And then the president, Gaviria, decided to come to the conference. So, I mean, to the art fair. So he, Garcia Marquez, came with him. And I was only told, like, at the last minute that he was coming. And I was, you know, thrilled over the moon that I'd have a chance to meet him. So I'm in my booth kind of waiting for them to arrive. And, of course, you can't see the door of this giant convention center. And across, I hear some, you know, kerfuffle, like, that, you know, something's happening. And it was the president arriving with his press corps and whatever. And the next thing we hear is a huge roar and a cheer, like Madonna had entered the room, right? And it was Garcia Marquez. And I thought, you know what? You got to love a country that gets that a politician is only important for a minute in time, but an author like Garcia Marquez is for the
forever.
Centuries,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I was in love with Colombia ever after that. So, and he was a very gracious man. He was friends with a lot of artists. One artist, Ana Mercedes Hoyos, who I did show in the gallery. And he, no one ever had a bad word to say about him except his political foes who felt he was a communist. I don't really consider him a communist. I would say he was more of a socialist. But, you know, he had this wonderful, quirky way of describing his life and time. So,
wow.
So rest in peace, right?
Yeah. So now in the book, there was a kind of a, I don't want to give away anything. I don't want to give any spoilers. But there was a a contemporary artist who you is very whose works from Colombia, whose works were selling for millions of dollars. Was that based on somebody real?
Well, all fiction is based on something real if you're going to make it believable. But yeah. I'm not going to say any artist's names, okay? I mean, this artist made works with very thin people who had big feet. That was his signature.
Okay.
And that I know of. There probably is an artist like that somewhere, but I don't know that person. So
okay.
I consider it completely fictional. But it is true that there have been artists in Latin America and the Caribbean and Mexico that have risen to huge financial thresholds. And that was the way it was for this fictional artist. So as I said, you know, it's always perilous when you're dealing with a contemporary artist that has these prices that go crazy, because why? They can always make more art, a lot of art. I am not a fan of putting living artists up for auction because the supply is too flexible, but you'll get a lot of others who disagree. And surely a lot of contemporary artists are at auction, but people can manipulate auction prices. People protect their artists, dealers and gallerists. If an artist gets in an auction by somebody, a collector or whatever, and nobody bids on it, I mean, that's kind of pretty devastating. So you will work hard at making sure there's some bidders there. So it's a there's a lot of funny behind the scenes in auctions.
So there was a Colombian artist that I saw in Venice. I saw he had an outdoor exhibit throughout Venice when I was there in 2003, and that's Botero. So yes. And he painted very plump characters.
Yes, that is true. And I think it just put one of the bronze statues of a very fat woman that sits in Cartagena in a public square on my website and on my Instagram. You can see it there because somebody brought a friend, took the book 5 Days in Bogota and put it in her hands. And so she's sitting there all fat and naked reading the book. But anyway, Botero's works you can see in a lot of places. I never met Botero, but I met some of his family members, and I never represented Botero. I wasn't especially a fan of his aesthetic, being rather plump myself. It was kind of like, okay, I don't need this.
Right? Or he could have been glorifying plumpness, depending on how you look at it.
You read about him, he talks some about, you know, how volume is an aesthetic thing, right? And you know, you can do a lot with interpreting it. It's funny. I had a Colombian friend who is a member of the elite. She was never an art client, but she does collect a lot of contemporary art. And she did not believe me that, you know, Botero was at all involved with the cartels and the ugly part of their history. And I sent her a story about how Botero had learned that Escobar owned one of his works, or maybe more than one. And he was so annoyed at him that he actually made a piece of a big fat guy that was clearly Escobar being shot on the roof of a building, which is the way that the Colombian military did eventually kill Escobar. So it's like Botero documenting Escobar's demise. Oh, wow. And I think my friend was shocked because she, you know, that Botero even thought about the cartels. I think there is a kind of blinders on of the certain population about what's going on, but it was tough to ignore. I mean, they blew up the Supreme Court building, killed a lot of people. That's a tough one to ignore, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not like there's, you know, like sometimes that happens here. It's like, oh, well, in that neighborhood where all the gangs are, that's where, you know, shootings happen or drive-bys or whatever. And we tend to think, I used to tutor kids down in a neighborhood in San Diego that had, you know, they were on probation from the juvenile courts. They would always say, I'm not a criminal. And most of them weren't criminals. It was really stupid because we tend to criminalize a lot of things in this country that are not crimes, like missing school. Like if you're truant, you get sent to the police, not to do an extra study hall or something, yeah. Like in my day, right? Or
right.
Pick up trash on the playground or whatever. I would say to them, I would drive 12 minutes from my house to be there to tutor them. And I was like on a different planet. And I think that happens in Latin America. Well, it happens everywhere where you tend to sort of stay in your bubble and not really and ignore the troubled places. It's getting more difficult. The trouble is spreading. And I think, you know, when you're on Fifth Avenue in New York or Madison going down fancy shops and you're stepping over homeless people to get in your favorite boutique, I think you can't ignore that there are people who are desperate in our country. And that happens all, that's been true in Latin America for a long time. These contrasts between desperately poor people and very, very wealthy people.
And it does seem like you're right. It's getting more here, that the difference between the wealthy and the poor is growing. The wealth gap is growing. And
although it's probably cyclical, you know, I'm sure at the turn of the 1900s, that was a big deal. And the Depression, that was also true. You know, let's hope we're cycling out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Good point. So, Linda, and I do want to mention, if you've just tuned in, we're talking to Linda Moore, author of 5 Days in Bogota. What made you decide to write books? Novels in particular.
I did not have a big dream of writing novels. I had closed the physical gallery. I continued to deal in art for quite a time after that, be a consultant in art and so forth. My two kids had graduated from college and were sort of, you know, on their way to the extent any kids are ever, right? but in any case, they, you know, a friend of mine had written a book and invited me to come to a read and critique group. And so I went just kind of thinking that would be a good activity in my retirement days. And I wrote a novel. And that novel, I submitted it to a book award. And not only did I not win, I got ruthless criticism back from the judges. And I kept it. How sick is that? I took it out and read it the other day. They were right, those judges. And I'm grateful to them because it inspired me. I realized I'd written a lot, you know, but it was nonfiction stuff. It was about artists and art, and writing fiction is a very different thing. So I decided to go back to school. I applied to Stanford's novel writing program, and I spent 2 years learning how to write fiction. And I'm so glad I did. I am so grateful to those teachers. And I really, encourage anybody who wants to write to go learn the craft, because there's a lot you can learn. There's a lot, like any art, that comes as inspiration, as something special, a talent, a voice that you as a writer have. But there are many, many things that are just plain wrong that you don't do. And there's much to be learned. So I worked at it for many years. I traveled a lot during those years. I went to over 100 countries. I lived on a ship and was gone about 6 months a year. And, you know, writing is something you can do almost anywhere. And nowadays it's so nice that you can do a lot of research on your computer. You don't have to necessarily go to a library. And so I was using a lot of my time during those days and, you know, getting better. When I was at Stanford, I wrote another novel. It's in the drawer. It's a requirement of the program that you complete a novel. And that actually is the biggest thing, challenge, is most people quit. It's a long, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Writing a novel.
So you've written two, and you've published two novels. So the first one you published was the third one you wrote?
Correct.
Yes. Correct. And that's not uncommon, I think, that you know, people get right. their practice novels out of the way and get it right on the third try. But how did you know that that was the one?
Well, I learned from the first ones I had written. The novel I wrote at Stanford has three narrators, braided narrative chapter at, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And it's a very complicated story. It works. The people who mentored me around that, you know, really like that story, but it's a very complicated story. So it's set in the Democratic Republic of Congo, just to like blow your mind. I think I'm going to go for a book in every continent. Okay. In any case, I think I, after that book, I was kind of burned out. It was, you know, a lot to get your arms around. So I wanted to write a novel with one narrator, a straight timeline, and just tell the story, right? And that was Attribution. And I followed with 5 Days in Bogota, which is also one narrator and a straight timeline, although set in an earlier time in the 90s, which made it difficult because there were no cell phones and a lot of no computers. I mean, it's, you have to remind yourself constantly. When I was, you know, proofreading and checking, my daughter, who's an attorney, read the book, and she's a pretty good proofreader, and she alerted me. She said, "Mom, on this page you said she had no time to check her emails. You can't say that in 1990. Oh, right. Okay, I paged to check her or read her mail, open her mail. But anyway, yeah, so I think that many readers have thanked me for not jumping around chapter in, you know, 1920 and then a chapter in 2020, you know, that they appreciate just telling a straight story. And I think there is a lot to be said for that. But writers like to experiment with different approaches, and like art, everybody is entitled to their own style and their own approach.
That is for sure. And I did notice that your writing style is different than a lot of books that I read. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it seems in some ways more spare and direct.
Well, I'm an admirer of Hemingway.
Okay, there you go.
And you know, there is something there. There are a lot of writers who are journalists. Garcia Marquez was a journalist. And while his writing has its magical realism style, I think there is something about not getting carried away with yourself. I don't, you know, I'm one of those readers who jumps to the dialogue. Are you like that? I mean, yeah. I love your beautiful prose, your poetry, and so on. And it's needed because you want to see and feel what that narrator is seeing and feeling. But you don't need sometimes as much as the writer wants to give you. So I am not one to get carried away with my own descriptions. And you know, I'm not saying that isn't a lovely thing to do. I've read some things recently that just take my breath away. They're so good. But if you're going to do that, you have to be really good.
Yes.
You know, the choice of every word, every sentence, it matters. So I think, though, I do criticize myself a lot, and I listen carefully to, I think Richard Russo read 5 Days, a big chunk of it. And he said to me, "Grace and flow, Linda, grace and flow." So I'm after grace and flow. That's my new goal.
Yeah, it's, I understand, because I've actually had some of my writing criticized for being too, I don't know, too direct or too spare. Actually, I get criticized for being too direct, but that's another story. And
you probably like it. You like reading when it's for your way.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a tough thing to get to have that kind of the Hemingway-esque spareness of words and get the flow too. So, yeah, that is an amazing thing to be able to do. So I congratulate you.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you think I got at least partway there. I'll tell Richard Russo that you said so.
Okay. But, you know, as always, we can all do better. Did you have any trouble finding a publisher for your books?
Well, I guess I'm one of those people that's grateful for COVID. So I'm sitting around here without being able to travel and not much to do. And I said, all right, I'm going to really focus on finishing these novels. And I did an online webinar, symposium of a it was about routes to publishing or something like that. And they introduced all kinds of people, including this very high-end, one of the good guys' agents, literary agents. And he said to the group, we used to respond to everybody's queries within 6 weeks. That was our goal. And now it's 6 months with COVID, I've got to tell you. So at that point, I was in my early 70s, and I said, I don't have 6 months for you to tell me that you aren't interested in my book, right? So I started looking at some of these other options that were presented in that class, and I learned about what's something called hybrid publishing, and I like to call it co-investing in your book. So I am with She Writes Press that does have a they vet books. They don't take anybody with a checkbook. And there are standards for this. And so I urge everybody to be careful and look at some of the Independent Book Publishers Association's criteria and some of those things. But what you do is you pay some money in to have them make a book, which I did not have the bandwidth nor desire to learn how to make a book. But making a book is a complicated thing.
Oh, yeah.
And doing it correctly. And I can pick up a book instantly and know it's been self-published by an amateur. You know, I was able, because I was involved with it, to get great input on the covers, on a number of other things, where we presented it, how we presented it. And I feel like I work with them as a team, partners, co-investors. And some authors, you go with a traditional publisher, you may get zero to be able to say about your cover, about other aspects of your book. She Writes also has traditional distribution. So the book is available like any traditionally published book. And I can't emphasize enough how important that is.
And you're right. They do. Their books do look like, I mean, they are professionally published books, and I've done quite a few authors from She Writes Press and have always been impressed with the quality of the books and of the writing, too. So we are unfortunately out of time, Linda, so we're going to have to wrap it up. And we always end with a quote. So I found one from Gabriel Garcia Marquez that I think is apropos. It is not true that people stop pursuing dreams because they grow old. They grow old because they stop pursuing dreams.
Oh, that's a great one. That is a great one. I thank you so much for the time and the conversation today. I've enjoyed meeting you. I hope we cross paths again.
I hope so, too. All right. And that's all for Writers' Voices today. See you all next week.